This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast for Wednesday, December the 18th. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Thank you so much for joining me for this week's episode. So the plan, because there's been 2 weeks in a row with an interview, was that I was going to do a solo show this week. However, looking at the calendar over the next couple of weeks, it's holiday weeks. Thinking I'm probably going to put out the podcast on a different day the next couple of weeks, since Christmas and New Year's both land on Wednesday, which is the usual drop day. But then also, those are probably going to be solo shows for the holidays. So I thought it'd be cool. I got a great interview in the can, if you will, from a psychotherapist in TMS, treating TMS, treating chronic pain. So we're going to hear from her in just a second. But I wanted to start off by thanking the patrons of the podcast. So if you go to patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast, you can make a monetary donation to the show. There's certain perks that are involved in there, different posts. I've posted podcasts early a couple of times. I've done some video content a couple of times over there. But really, it's just a thank you for the show. There are costs that come along with putting out a podcast or a YouTube show or whatever. And so that's really what it's designed to be. So I wanted to give a thank you to Jennifer. A thank you to Eddie. Thank you to Jenny. Thank you to Sean. Keep scrolling down here. Big old thank you to Christina, Holly, Caroline, Julie, Ross, Casey, Alyssa, Brian, Sarah, Adrian, Stan, Kristen, Sarah, Helen, Arnie, Kim, and Barb. Thank you all so much for your continued support of the podcast. This is obviously a labor of love. Certainly, it's not paying the bills. And so I do have a day job. I've got a family. I've got two kids. You know, I've got a bazillion things going on. But this podcast is near and dear to my heart and getting this content out to people because I think it is. I think it helps a great deal. So, and with that being said, my voice is at the end of the road. We're getting to the end of the road. So we're going to jump on and listen to Jennifer Huggins, which is, it's an awesome episode. A little bit different approach. And it reminded me a lot of Liz Wallenstein a couple of weeks ago. I think that you'll really enjoy this. So here is Jennifer Huggins. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. And with me today is Dr. Jennifer Huggins from West Los Angeles. Jennifer, are you there?
I am here.
We've had some audio issues and now Jennifer sounds crisp and clear and lovely. And as I told you, I think it's cool that your first name is the same as my wife's, Jennifer, but then Huggins as a therapist, I don't think it could get better than that.
That's true. Yeah. You have a point.
So one thing about like TMS psychotherapy in Southern California is it kind of seems like the Pain Psychology Center sort of has a monopoly on that down there. And then when I started talking to you and I'd said, do you work there? And you'd said no. And, you know, a lot of people, if they don't live in state of California, particularly Southern, they just kind of group, you know, LA, San Diego, Orange, Irvine, Hollywood. Sure. They're all the same town, right?
Right. True, true.
But here you are. And so I'm excited to dive in because there's a lot of things that I see you say online that really resonate with me, a lot of the stuff and kind of your approach to this work as like a practitioner. And so that's what I wanted us to dive into today.
Great. Let's do it. I'm excited. This is my passion. So I'd love to talk about it for hours and hours.
Good. Good. Well, maybe let's maybe we'll kind of start on why you're doing, you know, there's a lot of things that people can go to school for when it comes to like therapy in general, and then they kind of pick a specialty, and this is where you landed. So let's start there, like, and then we'll go back and kind of the, you know, the genesis story of it. But what made you get into this as like a subtopic of therapy?
Okay, so I was actually in grad school when my own chronic pain developed, and I took a leave of absence, and I was actually not in any type of health psychology track or any type of pain psychology, you know, even mindset at the time. And I took a leave. And then as I was getting better, I went back and I realized, hey, there's a health psychology track here that I wasn't even on my radar. I hadn't even noticed when I had been in, you know, grad school prior to leaving. And so I went through a lot of hoops and changed my emphasis to just an individual adult to health psychology. And it was because of my own personal experience of having gone through chronic pain and healed myself through the TMS treatment that it became just a huge, huge passion of mine, both personally, and I knew I wanted to really delve into this professionally and help others. So I emphasized in health psychology with my doctorate, and then I went on to subspecialize in pain psychology and get lots of training in that and to become a pain psychologist, which is what I'm doing now.
So this stuff, you're actually the second person in a row that I've, there's an interview that hasn't aired yet, but by the time people hear this, it will, where the person was struck by this kind of stuff while they were going into, for them, it was going to nursing school, but I feel like any sort of like advanced level academia, sometimes like just, you know, the pressures of life oftentimes are really punching you in the face in that point in time. So what kind of, and we'll get back into going back a little bit further, but at that point in time, when you were actually in grad school, what sort of things were happening like symptom wise for you?
Well, what happened is I actually just woke up one morning with excruciating bladder and pelvic pain, like literally out of the blue. Yeah. It wasn't there the night before, and I woke up with it. And I was doubled over in pain, didn't know what was going on. It felt like just like a horrific bladder infection. And so that's what I thought it was. And I went to the doctor, and I didn't culture anything out, but they gave me antibiotics anyway. And I went on many rounds antibiotics because everyone just thought, well, maybe there's, you know, something just not showing up or whatever the reasoning was. I'm not quite sure. And then after loads of different doctors, I was finally diagnosed with interstitial cystitis, or IC,
yeah,
which is, dubbed an incurable chronic bladder disorder, inflammatory bladder disorder that can only be managed throughout one's lifetime. And so that was a really scary thing to hear. I was about 23 and 24, something like that. And I was given, you know, a lot of information such as that, a lot of fear-based messages, and given a very long list of foods that I had to avoid or it would flare my bladder pain up, and then a very short list of foods that I could eat and that were quote-unquote safe. So I started obsessing about that, and there went my journey.
And then as you, once you began, like, well, maybe let's back up. So, how did you get exposure into TMS stuff? Is this being your way? Cause people will sit there and ping pong across the Western. I mean, I know, I'm sure we can both think of tons of people in our lives that ping pong across the Western medical model. For some people it's a month and some people it's 25, 30 years. Schubiner told me there was a woman that he was working with for 37, like that was 37 years deep that he worked with. And so, how long did you sort of go and do this, you know, the typical treatment or protocol or whatever? And then what made you stumble across TMS, psychological based work?
Right. Well, it took a long time. So I would say a good 8 years, I was in the Western medical model.
Damn.
And I actually call it the medical merry-go-round. And that's what I was on. And it just spun slower and slower, and or maybe faster and faster. I'm not quite sure. But I went everywhere. I had all the typical treatments, bladder installations, hydrodistension, cystoscopy with hydrodistension, which was very painful, medications, nothing worked. I actually flew all over the country to see quote-unquote IC specialists, really went everywhere. And nothing worked. And during that time, you can imagine I became more and more, you know, helpless and hopeless. And I actually became I became clinically depressed. I was really, really, really depressed. And, you know, my pain got worse. And so, you know, of course, I believed that the pain got worse because of what they were telling me, because I had one doctor told me my bladder was the worst bladder he had ever seen. I had another doctor say that my bladder had ulcerations in it and it was bleeding from all four quadrants. So, you know, you get these messages and they really install a lot of fear. So as my pain got worse, I had this sort of visceral image in my mind of like, oh my gosh, the ulcers are getting worse, or oh my gosh, the bleeding's getting worse, or the bladder's getting even worse than what that doctor saw. And, you know, that was my belief as to why my pain was getting worse. But now looking back, I really know it was the fear, the stress, the depression, and the nocebo effects that I had been taking on, which is belief in harm leads to harm, that led me down a road of more pain. I just didn't know it at the time because I was thinking so structural and physical.
Well, and when you have those images that they're giving you, it's, you know, it's like, I know that the, again, going back to the guy who's the nurse, there was plenty of things that he was told that created a lot of imagery. And it sounds like that was a big part of
your it really sticks too. In your mind. Yeah. And whether they, you know, whether they are painting a picture for you or not, you create one in your own head, you know, whether you realize it or not, it just sort of sticks in there. You may not even know that that image is sort of, you know, is influencing you, but you know, we all kind of think in these different ways, visual and verbal.
Well, a big part of like Steve Ozanich's unwinding in his book that he describes is like the inverse of that, where he's imagining and viewing this perfect spine running on clouds, right?
But I did that.
Yeah.
I did all sorts of things like that. I did so many things to heal. You can't even imagine. It was a smorgasbord of healing once I got there. So to answer your question as to how I got there, is after years and years of Western medicine, then I went to alternative medicine, everything from acupuncture and herbs to people chanting over my bladder to medical psychics. I mean, you know, did that whole thing too. And then once that didn't work, I actually stumbled upon a forum online called ic-hope.com. I don't know if it's still around. And this was a forum that was mostly women, 99%, I'd say, that were all struggling with IC or like pelvic pain disorders. But they were all really trying to heal it naturally. And they were really looking for alternative solutions. So I really spent a lot of time on there, and I developed some close friendships, and we all sort of supported each other. And it was a place of solace for me at the time, because you feel so alone when you're in pain. You feel so lonely. And it's so comforting to talk to someone who understands. So that was a really useful thing emotionally for me. But then I learned of a coach, and her name is Abigail Stidley. And I started coaching with her. And she's actually the person who introduced me to Dr. Sarno.
Okay, hold on. Small ass world. So I got an email from somebody maybe 2 days ago, because in the last episode that aired, I was talking about, I was giving shout out to the people that had made donations to the podcast, and I accidentally had said Abigail, and somebody emailed me and had said, hey, I noticed that like right before your name or right before you read my name, you had said Abigail, you know, what's the story with that or whatever. And I said, I've been emailing back and forth with this woman, Abigail Stedley, about coming on to the podcast, and here she is, brought up. Small world. Okay, continue. Sorry.
And I don't even know if she knows how influential she was in my healing. And I really have been, I should reach out to her and just, you know, and maybe she'll hear this. I hope she will. So it was a long time ago that I coached with her. I don't even know if she would remember me. So we coached together for probably just a few months on a regular basis. And she introduced me to Dr. John Sarno. And I read his book, and it sounds cliche, but honestly, that was it for me. It clicked. It made perfect sense. Now, I wasn't one of the ones where my pain vanished when I read the book, but I had a huge surgence of hope. And it was a way I hadn't tried. It was something that was really opposite of everything I had tried. And it made sense for me because I'm psychologically minded. So it all sort of clicked. And I just ran with it. So I started reading his books over and over and over. I actually rewrote his books out like several times from start to finish in notebooks, just for the reprogramming process of the brain, just to really, really get that pain, these new pain beliefs installed in my brain, because, you know, it's very likely that the brain resists this.
Yep.
You know, it resists the TMS, it resists the theory, because the pain, your brain thinks it's protecting you by giving you this pain. So it doesn't want you to, you know, go a different route and feel your emotions and all of those things, face those inner truths. And besides all of that, it's just a totally new language. So it's, you know, it's like, huh, what is all of this? It's very confusing to the brain because we've never thought of pain this way. So, you know, even though it totally clicked with me, my brain would still fight it, you know, on a mild level, but it was there. And with the clients I work with, you know, a lot of skepticism and doubt could come up for them. And so we have to work through that. So I don't know how much further you want me to go into what I did.
So, yeah, no, that's because I feel like sometimes because my belief in the quote unquote blueprint, which is not, it's not even a good term for it. But what I would advise people, because I do calls with people and it seems like certain things, it's just like with a teacher or I mean, with anybody that's really trying to give a particular way of doing something. Like I've observed, you know, weightlifting coaches over the years that explain the same thing to two different people and it's explained totally different, right? Which is a great, which is a great teacher. And so I explain this stuff in different ways and recommend certain things that they do, but it's almost like different things are going to be better for different people. So for you, like what sort of, you know, was it journaling? Was it meditation? Was it belief? Was it reassurance? Was it brain talking? That kind of thing. Like what were some of your, you know, your golden geese.
Yeah. Definitely. I did journal. I did meditate, but I wouldn't say those were the core things that got me there. I think they really helped unwind my nervous system, help keep me calm, help me cope with the pain when it was, you know, still there. But I think mine was really the reprogramming and the change, the really just, you know, 100% change in pain beliefs. And then with that, very, very much not reacting to the pain in the same old ways. So my whole thing was really learning how to develop a different relationship with the pain. One, going from fear of the pain, panic of having the pain, to really developing a very neutral, kind of lackluster, you know, attitude toward the pain, where I really cultivated a not caring. Just not caring. And the reason, the only way I could do that was full belief that I had DMS. Full belief that this is what was going on.
Talk a little bit about the reprogramming part of it, because, you know, that means different things to different people. Define that.
Yeah. So the reprogramming for me was, again, just literature and really diving into the literature. So rereading books over and over. Like I said, I wrote Sarno's book out several times in its entirety. And I also reread like other non-TMS books, but they were, you know, equivalent theme, like The Biology of Belief by Herbert Benson and Timeless Healing and things like that. I believe it's Herbert Benson. Am I right there? No, Bruce Lipton. Sorry about that. And then I had like post-it notes all through my apartment, you know, saying things like think psychological, not physical, hurt doesn't equal harm. Do not fear the pain. It's only TMS, just everywhere on my mirror and just everywhere I could. So I was always reminded of it.
Yep.
I was living in San Francisco at the time and I would listen to Sarno's books or other, you know, Osnish's books or whatever on audio because I didn't have a car as I was walking around the city, as I was on the Muni. So it was always in my head, just the reprogramming process. So it really became, you know, such a full-fledged clicked with it. It was real and my brain just needed to get on board. And so very much that. And then looking for evidence that the pain was TMS was huge. So, you know, the TMS evidence list, really recognizing all the like inconsistencies of like, okay, so I took one sip of orange juice and my bladder's in a flare. That doesn't even make any sense. Mm-hmm. You know? And it was just because of the nocebo effect of you can't drink orange juice and all the fear. So my brain, of course, our brain always wants to protect us. Says orange juice, no, that's bad for you. So here's some pain so you don't do more of it. We don't want to hurt you more. You don't want to hurt yourself more. So it sends pain to protect you, but you really don't need to be protected. So I started understanding how that was working for me. So when pain would come on, I'd drink orange juice or whatever, I would just use a lot of self-talk and I would keep drinking the orange juice whether I had the pain or not. So I didn't let pain guide my activities or my behavior anymore. I didn't react to it. I didn't care if I had it. I just let it be there. I just didn't care. But it has to be a real like gut not care, not something you're like doing in your head to try to make the pain go away. You have to really genuinely say like, you know what? Fine, be there because I am smarter than you and I know way more and I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to buy into this. And so there's almost a little bit of like a, you know, you kind of have to like almost be like angry in some ways at times, like you're not going to beat me and have that kind of empowerment that comes with that.
One of the I love the evidence list idea. It's very in line with some of the stuff that Schubiner talked about on this show, whereas he would say things like, you know, you have your detective hat on. If this is, you know, if the pain happens at certain times, it doesn't happen at others, your detective hat is over. So he had all these examples, and I was thinking about like way before I found the Sarno book, but one of the inconsistencies that just never made sense to me was, why am I in less pain or no pain while lifting heavy weights, and then at rest I'm in excruciating pain? And it would be explained to me by a chiropractor or somebody. They would say, well, you know, the blood is flowing, and so your fascia is nice and loose, and that's kind of what's causing it. But then when I started, you know, later on after the Sarno stuff, when I started learning about the concept of viscosity and how, you know, fluids are constantly moving through your body, there's not really anything that's causing it to, you know, me going and running on a treadmill for 3 minutes to get warmed up, it's doing something, but it's not what's causing this, you know, the river of energy and blood and everything like that to flow through my body, even if practitioners would want you to believe that. And so, you know, that's certainly a big thing for me. So your approach sounds pretty similar to mine in that regard. And so was it like one day you wake up and this thing is gone, or how long did the waxing and waning take, if it did, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So, you know, there was some waxing and waning. It would, you know what? It was actually kind of like a roller coaster now that I'm thinking about it. It would be, you know, calm. And then I'd get like huge flare ups, and then I'd freak out. This isn't working. Oh my gosh. But then I just realized, you know, this idea of extinction bursts, you know, that came to mind, that, you know, sometimes our brain will, like, you know, I think other people have mentioned the metaphor of like the hamster running faster to get the cheese, like when you stop giving it. So I would comfort myself with that, and also realize that healing often doesn't happen in a straight line from chronic pain anyway. It's often an up and down process as you sort of ebb and flow and learn this new treatment and how to apply it, and your nervous system learns to calm down, right? So I just learned not to freak out and panic when that happened, and just reassure myself. And then what happened basically is one day I was walking around and I was like, oh my gosh, I haven't had any pain today. And it was like, you know, later in the day, and I hadn't even recognized it because I had become so disconnected with the power and the care that I had for even having the pain that I wasn't even like looking for it anymore. Cause that was the big thing. I'd always anticipate it. I'd look for it. Is it worse? Is it better? You know, why isn't this working? Oh my gosh, it's worse. Oh my gosh. You know, and the panic and the fear that would come around that. I let so all of that really go, so that when the pain wasn't there anymore, I was so just sort of ambivalent to it, you know, that I didn't notice. And then when I did notice, I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then I would get little, like, you know, spikes here and there, and just a resurgence of pain would come up, and I would deal with it the same way, and it would, you know, it would peter out. Until eventually, over, I'd say it probably took me a period of about a year where eventually I just became completely pain free. And I haven't had pain in roughly, I'd say, about like 12 years, 11 years now.
Oh, damn. Okay. That's awesome. How does that coincide with, you know, because this stuff really kind of jumped up in grad school. And so at what point in time were you in your career when the pain was finally, either when you had that 1 year period where it was like, oh, I've got you now, basically. And then you kind of have a year of this waxing and waning. And I'm sure that the majority of that was probably great, right? You're probably pretty symptom free. What were you practicing? How were you practicing at the time? How did that coincide with you? Cause I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
Once you kind of have this awakening and you're like, no, I've definitely got it figured out now, that it's almost like I would imagine it's like you've got a shot of adrenaline now in your career, because you're like, I just figured this, you know, I just figured out what happened to the Titanic, right?
Like, yeah, that's how I feel sometimes. Like, I'm always saying that I'm screaming that the world is round and everyone's screaming back that it's flat.
Yep.
It's often the experience.
Yep.
But I was actually in my postdoc. I was doing my postdoctoral fellowship at the time when the pain was really resolving. And then I moved on to a you know, the pain was pretty much not an issue when I really started working at a pain clinic up in the Bay Area. I worked at a functional restoration pain clinic, and they were doing really more of like a, you know, a standard CBT management model. And so, you know, I learned that and I taught that, and I was, you know, I tried to, you know, plug in Sarno and TMS wherever I could without, you know, really disrupting what, you know, the mission and the vision of the clinic was,
right,
and what the doctors, you know, hired me to do. So, but, you know, you can kind of wiggle it in there in its own way and talk about the nervous system and stress and, you know, kind of the same thing said in a different way. So I would do that. And then I would just sort of mention Sarno, and then, you know, the clients or the patients that wanted more information, you know, we would do that kind of more one-on-one.
So are you, would you like at this, like at that point in time, not today, 2019, almost 2020, I can't believe it. But is it generally like referrals coming from, you know, a typical Western medical doctor, like an orthopedist or like some, like,
no.
How were people finding you at that time?
At that time, I was at a clinic and we were doing mainly workers' comp. And so it was, you know, definitely doctors and physicians that were on a workers' comp case, but I was working for a company.
Got it.
So they weren't finding me. They were finding the clinic I was working at. I was getting my hours and working towards my license and to sit for the state exam. And then once I got licensed, I actually moved on to Kaiser Permanente, where I worked in the pain management department as a pain psychologist. And I was there for, you know, roughly about 6+ years until November of last year. And now I'm just in full-time private practice.
So one thing that, it's not like I have, this is going to sound really stupid, but, I'm a big like superhero movie buff, and there's this great scene in Avengers Endgame where, and I'm not going to spoil the movie, but, where all the Avengers get together and it's kind of like the final fight, the final battle in the movie. And sometimes that's kind of how I imagine TMS practitioners, coaches, podcast hosts, even just people that are like Abigail and I who are standing on the rooftops and trying to scream to ad nauseum about it.
We're doing the same.
Yeah, we're all sort of like gathering as the Avengers taking on the final fight of a lot of times I feel like it, A, Western medicine, but two, insurance companies. And so talk a little bit about, because I don't know a ton about Kaiser Permanente. What I do know, though, is that I am regularly now hearing ad campaigns with companies like Kaiser and Cigna, who are emphasizing emotional health as being a basis of physical pain. And so I don't think the ad campaign was around then at the time. Maybe it was. But okay, was there any sort of like a conflict in working in that environment where, I mean, you're a pain psychologist that's there, and so your peers are probably people who believe the same stuff that you do. But I have to imagine there's people within the company that don't necessarily believe that that's the cause or the root cause.
Correct. Well, actually, I was the only pain psychologist, okay, so I had no peers. So it was me, and I had two physical therapists who were, you know, they're on board but didn't know Sarno. I introduced them Sarno to them, but they were, you know, open, but, you know, still physical therapists, but very, very evil physical therapists. So they were great. But I worked very loosely with them, and I taught classes that were CBT classes, but, you know, I had autonomy. So I was really able to bring a lot of this into my classes, which was really cool. And you know, mainly my work was with the MDs. So I was in the pain management department with all MDs and, nurses and me. So, the doctors, no, they weren't really, I wouldn't say they were totally on board with TMS and Sarno, because it's just not their training, you know, it's just not their training, and it's just not what they have learned and what they've learned to believe and how they practice. So, you know, in some ways you can't fault them for that, but, you know, they sort of, you know, they would deal with the MRIs and the pathology. And, you know, sometimes I would sit, you know, across and hear MRIs being read to clients and patients. And sometimes it was hard to hear, but, you know, I tried to work, you know, collaboratively and do my best job there. And when I saw clients, you know, in many ways, I would just, you know, try to insert my own education. And then it was really up to the patient, as far as, you know, what path do they want to go? What makes the most sense for them? Because they're the ones ultimately that have the free will. Do they want to keep doing the epidural, cortisone, radio frequency ablation route, surgery route, or do they want to potentially try something different? So at Kaiser, the doctors would refer to me. So, you know, they knew the value, at least, of CBT. I think they were more, you know, understanding of the management approach rather than the resolution of pain. And that's really the, you know, the delineation I think that happens is there's like belief in we can manage and help you cope with the pain. And I think a lot of doctors now are on board with that because there's a lot of research to support CBT for pain, like traditional CBT. But as far as resolving the pain and healing it completely to its zero, you know, zero pain, I think that is what, you know, a lot of practitioners are more skeptical about and don't think is possible.
See, that's the distinction that I make when I, there's some people that are in my, not my close circle, but in my, the people that I observe that are now aware of these types of concepts and they're trying to implement them. And I think that they sort of make the connection that it's like, oh, if it's the nervous system, some of the stuff that I can read online as activating the parasympathetic nervous system is around breathing exercises and meditation. And I feel like they go far too down that route, which is much more of a pain management thing, right?
Very much. Very much. Yeah. I mean, you can meditate till you're blue in the face, but if you're not changing your pain beliefs, in my opinion, your pain's not going to resolve.
One interesting thing that you mentioned a minute ago was like basically leaving it up to the patient. You get a referral from a doctor, person comes in, do they want to go down this radiofrequency, ablation, you know, MRIs, epidurals, all that stuff. Say that you had 10 people that came into the office as a referral. What's the number of people that are going to go, that are going down, and this is at that time when you're working in that environment, how many people are going to be going down out of 10 down your road, and how many people are going to be going down the, you know what, this stuff's a little too woo-woo, I'm going to keep going with the epidural stuff?
Yeah, good question. Gosh, I'd say the people that really, really dove in and really took TMS treatment by the horns, I would say it would be like 3 out of 10.
Damn.
Maybe 4 out of 10.
Okay.
Some would grapple with it and, you know, kind of, you know, work with it, but really not be able, like, wouldn't be able to really get there. There was always, you know, some doubt or some skepticism or kind of like straddling both sides of the fence between the biomedical and the TMS world. But the people that would really take it and actually heal their pain and like go full force, I'd say maybe 3-4 out of 10. But that I found was a success.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you can get 1 out of 10, because this is really, really counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at Kaiser, especially.
Certainly.
You know,
yeah.
Because they're not seeking me out. They're not seeking out TMS treatment. They don't know anything about it usually. And that's different from my private practice. A lot of people seek me out because they know I do TMS treatment. So they're coming in with 50% of the work, if not more, done, which is they have at least partial, if not full, you know, or some belief that they have TMS. And so a lot of the work is already done there.
How, and we're going to get into that, but the one last question that I would have, so I've had Nicole Sachs on the podcast 3 or 4 times now, and she's got a really big belief that in the, you know, within the next decade, that there will be a pretty big shift in public consciousness and, you know, even the medical model as far as referring into this kind of stuff or discussing this kind of stuff as a line of treatment. I mean, what do you see? You've been doing this a long time. You've worked at major companies that at least are making the effort to hire a pain psychologist.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you think, you know, that 3 to 4 people that are grasping in and feel like they really get it, if you were to take that job on 10 years from now or 20 years from now, do you think that number is different?
Gosh, I don't know. You know, that's a really tough question. I really hope so, but it's so political and complicated. You know, and the 3 to 4 at Kaiser is different than in my private practice. I'd give you a totally different number.
Yep.
You know, I think it's the context with which we see the clients, you know, and it's a different milieu. So will it be a different number? I don't know. I mean, that really depends on our insurance companies going to buy into this. Are doctors going to change their practice? That's what makes me concerned because, you know, if doctors, you know, buy into this practice or, you know, start, you know, approaching this, like, what jobs do they have? What happens to all the, you know, money with the epidurals and everything? What happens to all of that? What's their training going to be like in med school for, you know, chronic pain? I mean, are they going to be more of like a coach? Is that what they're going to really want to do? So I'm not really, you know, I don't have a really educated or, you know, good opinion on that quite yet. I'm sort of grappling with that myself, that question.
It's a shitty thing to say, but it's the way that I think where I've landed in a lot of ways is that, you know, people in white coats, whether it be a chiropractor, if they wear a white coat, sometimes they do, or a medical doctor, like, unfortunately, there's so much power and authority in the effort of, maybe I need to buy a white coat, but when I go on sales meetings, but there's so much power and authority and belief in the white coat concept. Like, I go to a doctor, that's the official word, and that is what it is. And there's a lot of trust there, but I feel like, therapy as a whole doesn't matter whether it's somebody coming for pain psychology or even if they, it could be a variety of things, family issues, you know, could be a variety of issues that's almost looked at as like lesser than, right? And it's not, even like the training is necessarily all that different, and the, you know, the cases that you see, all that, like, I bet not just necessarily in your TMS practice, but just therapy in general, you've probably seen some shit, like you've heard some stories, and it's not really a lot different than, I mean, other than like the shock and awe of some traumatic thing. Somebody comes in the ER and they've been shot in the chest and you have all this blood and gore and guts and all that. Like, that's obviously very jarring. But for the most part, a lot of the stories for a doctor, I mean, they also see some shit, right? So there's not really all that different. I mean, as a therapist working on the inside, do you feel the same way as I do in that there's not as much seriousness taken towards your line of work versus somebody that's at a, you know, at a medical clinic?
Yeah, I really do think so, because I think so many people just don't know what it's about. You know, and I think clients, you know, when they're sent to a pain psychologist, you know, often, what do they think? They get, you know, often pain patients, they already feel stigmatized. They already feel, you know, sort of marginalized. Sometimes they don't feel believed. They don't feel like their pain's being taken seriously. So then they get referred to a pain psychologist, and then they feel more marginalized. Like, what, you think the pain's all in my head?
Yep.
You think it's not real? Like, how dare you, you know? So they're sometimes angry about that referral.
Yep.
So they're not really understanding what it's all about. So yeah, I do think that's true.
So, you know, now you're your own practice, you're your own boss. You're not, you're not working within the confines, whether they felt confining or not, of working with another company. What are some of the, you know, now that you're kind of solely focused, people find you on their own accord. And you've got a bazillion tools in your toolkit at this point in time. Generally speaking, what are some of the things that you tend to, I guess, quote unquote, prescribe, or methods or techniques or beliefs or resources or whatever? You know, what kind of things do you point at when you get somebody that comes in with chronic back pain, chronic neck pain, fibromyalgia, headaches, all that stuff?
Yep. Well, the number one thing I always look for before anything else is what their pain beliefs are. So what are their pain beliefs? What are they believing is causing their pain? Because that's what if it's not TMS in its entirety, then that's where my work's going to be. Is if it's TMS for, you know, first, is if it's TMS, then my work is going to be undoing those structural pain beliefs and helping the client undo them for themselves. So that's the number one thing I assess. And then with that, it's education, 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 education. That's everything. So a lot of education. That's just the first step. There's really no other way through, because you have nothing to talk about otherwise. They don't know really where you're coming from. They're coming from a different mindset. So I do some education, and, you know, when I first meet them, but then I really ask them, sometimes even before the first session, is to get, you know, Sarno's book or to get another book, and then really see how they digest it. You know, come in with questions, write questions down, write, you know, highlight parts that resonated for them. Let's talk about those. And, you know, and really toss those back and forth. And that really is a rich start to therapy. Because you can really get a sense of, you know, where this person's at, how strong their structural pain beliefs are, how open-minded they're going to be to a TMS model, how motivated they're going to be to work a model like this and to do the work between sessions, and then how ready they are. That's a really important thing too. So I always say there's three things that really determine whether someone's going to be successful with TMS treatment, and that's open-mindedness, motivation, and readiness. So where are they on their pain journey? You know, are they at week one or are they at, you know, year 10? And that's really going to make a difference as far as, you know, how ready are they? I mean, that's one variable anyway. That's going to make a big difference about, you know, how ready they are to really delve into this and not feel like they have a bunch of medical boxes they're going to keep needing to check. Because if there's medical boxes, like, oh, well, there is that one thing that they said would really help, that's going to loom often over their mind. And they're not going to often invest as much in the work it takes sometimes to do TMS healing and treatment when they think there might be a quick fix out there.
Right. That right. It's like, maybe I didn't see this one chiropractor, that kind of thing.
Right. That one chiropractor that really like cured my friend's back pain. Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting. So, when I, in my quest, as I was kind of, you know, not half in, half out, but when I would think, oh, it is this one thing that maybe I haven't tried or haven't done yet. And then I would go and do that thing and it would be this weird, and you know, talk about this. If you have clients who experience this too, I would go and do whatever that modality is. And it would almost be like this boomerang whiplash effect where I'd go and do it and I'd feel 20% better for a couple of hours, then I would feel like 400% worse. Is that something that you experience? If people are kind of half in, half out and they're like, ah, this one thing, I'm gonna go try it, and then they do it and then they're way worse off, like, do you see that, or do they even tell you that they went and did that?
Oh, they tell me. Yeah, I'm very open. I'm not, you know, I don't punish people if they're going to go do stuff like that. I try to work with where they're at. So, you know, sometimes I see that. I see it's about 50-50. Sometimes just, you know, yeah, their pain gets worse. But I think some of that, actually, you know what? This just happened last night. That's funny that you bring it up. I saw a client last night and this person came in. And yeah, they had told me that they had seen a physical based practitioner, and that they had done some, you know, manipulation, some manual treatment, and they were really focusing on the labeling of the structural problem that was causing the pain and how they were manipulating that physical problem, right? So this person left and said, oh my gosh, I've been in so much pain ever since I left. And I said, well, what do you make of that? I don't know. I think maybe just the way they were moving the muscle or the nerve or whatever it was around. I said, well, can we look at it a different way? And so we agreed in the end that it was probably more likely due to the fact that she was focusing on the structural problem, which again goes back to leading to that nocebo effect, belief in harm leads to harm, that fear, that oh no, that panic, oh my gosh, I have this problem, what am I going to do about it? It's still not gone. And then that leads to more pain. So, you know, I think that is part of what can happen when we go get those treatments, is sometimes the messages we get when we go.
I used this example on a recent show, but that show Jackass, not around anymore. Do you know what I'm talking about? That old show Jackass or Bam Margera or any of that stuff?
I do.
So one thing I always think about when it's like fear of the activity, and people that have my brother's been nursing a partially torn quadricep for like 6 years, and this, you know, a low speed rear end car accident at 6 miles per hour, he's been nursing for 7 years, right? So I'm still observing that kind of thing, and even though he knows what my podcast is, I think he thinks it's bullshit, but I think about those guys that are like, you know, if you think about a task and it's going to hurt and you're going to have an issue, a lot of times in athletics and weightlifting, if I see somebody or observe somebody or even myself really hesitant to go up, this weight's going to be too heavy, I'm going to fail it, it's going to drop my head, all this kind of stuff, I'm either prone to miss that weight or more likely, maybe not more likely, but I'm prone to have something happen. Whereas if I just think like, I'll make the lift or I'll miss the lift, but I'll be fine and it's just a miss, like it is what it is kind of an attitude. Right. It's a big difference. But these guys on Jackass who were like, you know, they're not giving two thoughts to leaping off of a roof and having no problem. And they hit the ground and they're like, oh, you know, that hurt. But 3 minutes later, they're doing it again. They're not like,
I'm laughing.
And that's always like what I think about. I'm like, the body is so, and this is very Terminator-esque, which is another movie series that I love. But, you know, like T-1000 in Terminator 2 is walking towards the Terminator and just getting blasted over and over again with the shotgun because he doesn't have a fear of what's going to happen. And I'm like, man, if everybody could just adopt that, imagine just how limitless. There's a great movie with Bradley Cooper that I actually need to sit down and watch called Limitless, where this one reality, which is a pill, but it completely changes everything about his life. And that's a lot of what this is.
It's perception. Yeah, it's perception. It's reaction. Mm-hmm. And fear. Fear is huge. Fear is such a big thing I work with clients. Yeah. The fear and it's generally almost always a fear-based relationship to the pain that's fueling it, that's driving it, that's perpetuating it, that's keeping the nervous system in survival mode. And then, you know, and then of course there's trauma pieces too that I think sometimes we overlook. That, you know, clients may have trauma in their past. I mean, we have big T's and little T's, so we all have trauma in our past. And sometimes we need to treat trauma that there's trauma links to pain. So I actually do eye movement desensitization reprocessing, or EMDR.
Yep.
And I use EMDR quite a bit in my practice to sometimes just like reprocess beliefs like I'm not good enough, or, you know, I'm not lovable. Sometimes that, you know, funnel into those personality traits that Sarno talks about, the perfectionism, the self-criticism, the people-pleasing. So sometimes those are rooted in trauma, you know, traumatic incidents we've had, or just incidents we've had that really, you know, drove those into our belief system in our brain. So those can actually be trauma, and clients may not even realize that their brain is holding on to this in a traumatic way. So EMDR is another thing I work a lot with in my practice. To get back to your original question, as far as what I do.
Can you comment for a second, just because you just brought it up, small T's and big T's? You know, one thing that, and it was one thing that it took me a long time to get over, the fact that trauma is so each to their own, and it's defined so differently by people. And I think that the immediate thought, and I felt like this for a long time, is that trauma had to have been my dad punched me in the face. I saw murder. I was sexually assaulted. Like people think of trauma in all these different ways. When in reality, like, it really is up to the person and the brain of the person, the physiology of the person. Just, you know, talk a little bit about, and if you actually like, and obviously anonymousness. We'll call it that. If there's an example that you have, I get messages from a lot of people that are like, it's a great childhood, you know, nothing happened. I can't even point to anything, because I almost feel like those people are so rooted in the fear part of it, but not necessarily like they're trying to dive into the trauma pool when that's not even necessarily where they need to go. But they almost feel like their stories are not worthy of this. Can you just comment on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think clients often underestimate the traumatic nature of the events of their past, you know, and traumatic experiences are relatively common. So little T's are things that we might not see as trauma, like you just mentioned. So maybe like a passing comment by a teacher saying something critical to a child. That could be trauma. That could be a little T. Maybe, you know, some bullying. I don't know. That could be a little T. That could be a big T. Who knows? But for some, it could be a little T, depending on the magnitude. And the thing is, there's a quote. I think it's by Bessel van der Kolk, and he's a big trauma guy. And he says, trauma is not stored by the magnitude of an event, but by how that event is stored in the nervous system, you know, at the time of the incident.
Yep.
And so this means that there's so many experiences that can constitute as trauma, and it just really depends on how the individual internalizes it. So one person may internalize that passing comment by a fourth grade teacher as insignificant, and someone else might internalize it as I'm not good enough, and that can be the beginning of that core belief settling in.
Yep.
And so the more – and then we start sort of framing our world of, you know, looking for, you know, proof that we're not –
right.
So I think a lot of clients really don't recognize that. And then we go to talk therapy, and that doesn't really help for trauma. So reiterate your question. I just want to make sure I'm really
Well, it just lied more in the, you know, the, like, are there any examples or stories that you could give of somebody who comes in and it's not like they have this massive big T, but there's some little T's or like the example that you gave, some kind of a belief that happened at some point around the line and that sort of kept them stuck. Like, are there any examples of things that people aren't even thinking about?
I do. Yeah, I have a great example. So this is I'll change it up though, so it's not an actual case. I'll change up the factors, but it'll still represent it. So let's say the client was in, you know, elementary school and did some sort of project and felt really, really good about the project. And then, you know, let's say one of their caregivers comes in and, you know, the child at the time says, look how good I did. And then, you know, I was really proud of it. And, you know, of course, all children want validation from their caregivers. And instead, the caregiver, whether it be mom, dad, or whoever was the primary caregiver, criticizes it and says, well, you could have done better here. Or, you know, well, it's okay, but why did you do it? And the child just becomes crushed. I'm not good enough. What I do isn't good enough, you know, or I'm not worthy of my mom's validation or my dad's validation, you know. So these beliefs, because what happens with trauma is we develop a belief at the time of the event. We develop a belief about ourselves, others, or the world. That's what really imprints with the trauma. So, and it gets carried on throughout one's lifetime. And especially the more little T's we have, the more likely that's going to happen. Little T's of the same kind. So I don't know if that's a good example. Does that make sense?
It's almost, I mean, so here's the story. So it's very similar to what you're describing. And let me preface this by saying that I love my daughter's teacher, but the first week or couple of weeks, there was a couple of weird interactions that I addressed at the parent teacher conference and we got on the same level. I think a lot of times so much of adult conflict is just based on, we don't understand each other. And so, there was a point where my daughter had done some homework, that all the kids got the homework. My kid got the homework. She was so excited that she did it. She did a great job. And we came there and she turned it in and she said, I did it. Here it is. I'm so happy. And the teacher's snap response was, now if I could just get you to do the other things that I ask you to do. And I started to think, like, I would tell that story to people in my closer circle. And, you know, some people could empathize, but they kind of be like, oh, what's the big deal? It's just kindergarten or whatever. And I'm thinking, no, here's the thing. Like,
yeah. That's a great example.
Like that could care. And that sounds very similar to what you just told. And the other things I started picking up on was like, she's getting take home homework assignments and the other kids are not. And so it doesn't inherently seem like a big deal because it's just doing some ABCs and stuff before school. But what I was visioning was that my sweet little Zoe is, you know, she's looking across the room and looking at the purple folders of her classmates and none of the kids have anything in there. And she's the only one that does. There's no way that even a 5-year-old, as spacey as they can be sometimes, won't pick up on that.
Of course. Kids are a lot more intelligent and insightful than I think we give them credit for.
Yeah.
Yeah. They pick up on it for sure. So, yeah, I guess the belief there would be like, there's something wrong with me. I'm different.
I'm curious on, and this is just something that I get people that send me messages and, you know, they'll again, a lot of people kind of, again, they try to like to justify the trauma that they had or did not have. And so one thing that a couple people have messaged me about is like, you know, alcoholism or drugs in the family that may have occurred. And they're like, oh, but, you know, nobody hit me or nobody hurt me. But it was maybe more them observing a lot of things. Is there, you know, you had talked about this action happens as a kid and it sort of starts to have this I'm not good enough belief in their minds. Is there anything that you can say as far as like, you know, somebody's parent did a lot of drugs or somebody's parent drank a lot or they were an alcoholic, but they were nice to the kid or, you know, whatever. What sort of beliefs start to get rooted in a kid in a situation like that where their parent has a lot of these substance abuse issues, which are so prevalent? Is there anything that a kid sort of observes those things and then they start to think these things about themselves or about their world?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a variety, of course. It's hard to generalize, but certainly if a parent is, you know, a substance abuser and it's heavy and all of that, the likelihood is that they're not going to be fully engaged and available no matter what, right? If they're high and they're drunk, it's going to be, I would imagine, I don't know if you would agree, but it would be hard for them to be as present and engaged and available, whether it be emotionally or behaviorally or, you know, time spent or whatever, as someone who is not high or drunk.
Yep.
Or just high, I guess I can say. So, you know, clients may pick up on that. So, you know, there's degrees, of course. You know, maybe the parents passed out because they're so high. Or maybe they're just, you know, more invested in getting high than in the child. Or maybe they're trying to be a good parent, but they're just not quite emotionally available because they're numbed out from drugs and alcohol.
Yep.
So I guess beliefs could be, and kids may not put it together that it's the drugs and alcohol. They're always going to blame themselves because kids are egocentric. So everything is about them. They're the ones causing why mommy and daddy or mom and dad aren't giving us the attention and the love that they, you know, so desperately want. So a lot of the beliefs are very similar. They go back to the I'm unlovable, I'm damaged, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthwhile, I'm not worthy. Really those sort of, you know, self-disparaging, very common, I would say. And then when it comes to like more of the big T's and the abuse of, like, you know, sexual abuse or physical abuse, and I mean, maybe even a parent high or drunk, depending on where it goes, could be a big T. But, you know, some of those are more safety issues, like I'm not safe.
Right.
Or I have no control. Mom's so high and drunk and I don't know what to do. And it's really scary. Or I'm helpless, or, you know, the world isn't safe, or there's nothing I can do to protect myself. So then those beliefs can be carried on throughout time. And then we develop, you know, a lot of things I see in my practice often is fear of intimacy and closeness. And this comes from attachment wounds, attachment trauma. And certainly the example you're giving with a parent who's, you know, using a lot, there could certainly be some attachment wounds there because they're not able to attach to the parent in the same, you know, present, focused, secure way that I'm guessing that one would if the patient or the client's parent wasn't using. So they may have a more insecure attachment, anxious attachment, right? So all of these things could, you know, then, you know, imprint into romantic relationships, you know, usually is where it falls mostly in adulthood.
It's interesting you say that because the therapist who I worked with right after I read Sarno's book, and he was not a TMS therapist per se, but he had read Sarno. And as soon as I said that, I think it completely adjusted. Because originally when I called to set the appointment, he had said, what do you want to be seen about? And I said, I don't know, stress and anxiety. How about that? And I get there and I tell him about reading this book, and he was familiar with it. And I think that's probably where he adjusted some of his ways to which he worked with me. But he, the first thing he asked me was about intimacy with my wife. And then when I interviewed Dr. Margaret Chan, who's in New York, she, and we're going to do a follow-up, we're going to do a whole episode just on sex. As
okay.
I'm going to try and be mature when I do it, but
come on.
But she had talked quite a bit about that and said that that's just a big indication, like the health of the status of the intimacy between two people is a huge indicator, predictor, telltale for her as the therapist to somebody that has chronic pain. I feel like there's some kind of a correlation she was implying there, and eventually we'll catch up. But it sounds like you're saying a similar thing.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that's something I see quite a bit. Absolutely.
So yeah. There's like, as we kind of wrap up, there's like three things that, two things that you had said that I want to get some further clarification on, and then one that's a completely fresh question as we kind of wrap here. Does that sound good?
Great. Sounds good.
So very early on, you had talked about sort of unraveling or people determining what their own inner truths are. And Nicole Sachs's title of her book is perfect, The Meaning of Truth. And it's hard to define to people. Talk a little bit about what, you know, inner truths are to people. Maybe a couple of examples, but really, like, what does that mean?
Okay. So I think, you know, Sarno talks about having psychological conflict, you know, between one thing or the other. And that can, you know, be part of what drives TMS pain, or a lot of what drives TMS pain. So it's kind of on the backs of that. So the inner truths of being like, an example, we are married to our husband and we have children, but we really wish we could leave our husband because we don't want to be with them anymore. We're angry towards them. It's, you know, we don't, there's multiple reasons why we want to leave the marriage, but we make ourselves believe that we do want to stay because we don't want to break up the family. So we're in a lot of denial and rationalization and reasoning to stay with the husband when really it's not at all what we want to do.
Right.
So that would be an inner truth that one might not want to face. That might create a lot of psychological conflict that could certainly drive something like TMS pain because we're repressing all of our emotions around that and toward, you know, our husband.
Yep.
And maybe even towards, you know, I hate, you know, this is a taboo thing to say, but even towards children sometimes. Of course, we love them to death, but, you know, sometimes it's like, well, if I didn't have children, I could leave my husband. So sometimes that's the more risque things to go toward. And sometimes clients aren't willing to do that, and that's totally fine too. We don't have to. Sometimes we just deal with, you know, what clients are comfortable working with. But, you know, feelings are feelings. And so it doesn't mean that, you know, I don't think any feeling is wrong. I think just feelings are feelings. So I really try to encourage my clients to think the same way, is that, you know, whether it's anger or sadness or fear or joy, they're just feelings. There's no negative. There's no positive. So some clients can catch on to that, some not. But, you know, mainly just that's one inner truth. Another one might be, you know, we are in a career that we studied and studied and put tons of money into our degree, and there we are, but we really want to be an artist, and we're like a lawyer, we went to Harvard Law or something, and we really just want to be an artist on like Venice Boardwalk, and but we just can't face it because all of the studying and the money and what would people think, and so we just stay on the path of this job that we actually hate and that doesn't really fulfill our purpose or give us meaning. That might be another inner truth.
Do you generally find with people that have these kind of inner truths, whether it's I hate my spouse, I hate my kids, or I hate my job, or whatever these things are that you need to admit to yourself, do you find that those things have to be remedied or actioned upon in order to solve the, you know, solve the problem at least of the symptoms or whatever? There may be, you know, maybe you do need to leave your spouse, but some people just can't get there to even grasp the thought of it. Is it the grasping of the thought of it that's most important with your line of work?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think, yes, that's where, I mean, ultimately, if they were able to take the extra step and leave their husband and be free, that is ultimately what I think would be best.
Yeah.
But if the client is not able to do that, I'm not going to force them or push that upon them. And we're going to work again with where they're at. And we're going to do all the other work and all the other emotional work mainly that would be really important to focus on in that case if they're going to stay.
You segued perfectly into my next question / clarification. Earlier, you had talked about people doing the necessary work in between sessions. Can you just talk about some of the things that you prescribe or some of the things that you recommend people do in between seeing you?
So the classic TMS evidence list, right?
Yep.
That's the classic one. I mean, it's a must. The pain timeline is usually something I have them do at the beginning. I don't know have you heard of that?
It sounds like what I give is I actually just talked about it yesterday on the podcast. Is it where I have people make a two-sided column where on one side they put when the symptom was that occurred, what it was, and then on the right-hand side, what was going on in their life at the time?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. And that's for every little symptom from childhood on, stomach aches that, you know, happened a lot as a child, like anything they can think of, even TMS equivalents, you know, like, you know, IBS or tinnitus or whatever.
Yep.
Yep. So anything, even depression. So anxiety. And so I have them do that. And that's a really, really helpful thing with the evidence at the beginning. Again, the reading and the literature, the rereading. I do encourage some emotional journaling. I'm not super heavy on that, but I will encourage that. If clients like that, then I have them run with it. I have them do a lot of I have them practice their self-talk. I also work a lot with language. So like getting rid of like my pain and saying the instead. And sometimes I actually encourage people to just stop using the word pain and use the word sensation, because pain is such a loaded term. So working with language and practicing how to talk about pain differently and actually stop talking about pain.
Yep.
So stop talking about pain and actually educate people around us and ask our friends and loved ones to no longer ask us about our pain. And just, you know, that kind of stuff. And to begin to, you know, read TMS success stories or watch TMS success stories, particularly in times of doubt. You know, I really encourage, not demand, them to stop all physical modalities of treatment, you know, again, approach all avoided activities, and then really not to focus on getting rid of the pain, but really be like working on the cognitive, emotional, and behavioral responses to pain over and over and over again, and really working on that relationship with the pain to cultivate that neutral relationship, because it's something really that has to be cultivated. It often doesn't come just naturally. We have to cultivate it, and the only way we can cultivate a neutral relationship with the pain is through the literature and through the understanding and the deep understanding of TMS and the deep belief that that's what we have. So I have often encouraged them to read their TMS evidence list every day, particularly in times of doubt, and just a lot of education, and then coming in with questions and coming in with, you know, things that resonated, and then us capitalizing on that. And then me helping guide them further in how they're going to apply these things. And then, of course, working with the whole associative learning and the activities that they believe is causing their pain. That's a really sticky area.
Yep.
And so that can require a lot of work where we start, you know, using the evidence list and just using our own discussion to look for those inconsistencies. So a lot of like them coming in, talking about, you know, what's been going on in the week, and then me kind of reframing things and us tossing that ball back and forth is a lot of what happens. But reading, reading, reading.
The last question, and this is impossible to ask Dr. Sarno because he's no longer with us, but I feel like there is a conflict sometimes. This is the only conflict that I see. Well, one of the only conflicts I see in like traditional TMS therapy, which a lot of times involves journaling, but you had said it's not something you prescribe a ton of. But one thing I'm just curious on from the perspective of a therapist is that I've seen Sarno's lecture before. There was a DVD and it was on YouTube for a little bit. And a big thing that he emphasizes and really hammers home a lot is that he draws the example of what's above the surface, things that we know about. Cause you know, people would say, I know that I hate my job, but you know, that's not solving the problem. I still have pain. And then there's all the thoughts that are unconscious that are under the surface, which he says are, those are the things ultimately that are causing the problem. And, I feel like the next logical question would be, well, how do I figure out what those are? When are those things going to come out and I'm going to have an outburst and then my pain will be gone? And he always would correct them and say, these things aren't going to come out. It's just recognizing that they're there. And I feel like that kind of goes counter to a journaling idea where maybe you're writing out a bunch of things and expecting to have this aha moment or memory. So can you just talk about that conflict of thought?
So I'm not sure I'm completely understanding the question right, but are you asking me that? Can you say it one more time?
Yeah. So basically, the way that he would speak is that these thoughts are all unconscious and they're not something that's going to ever be able to come out. You just have to know that they're there and that you're angry about something under the surface. And
yeah, and I don't know if I totally agree with that. Yeah,
and I know his writing evolved, and then so there. But since then, there has been a lot of thought around and a lot of talk and work around journaling and writing these kind of things out. And to me, that seems a little counter to what Sarno may have originally said, because if you're just, you know, if you're writing down a bunch of things and trying to discover something, you know, maybe you're trying to discover a big moment or a memory or something, but it's never going to come out and those things are never going to become conscious. I don't know. I guess like, and you had said that, you know, you don't know that necessarily.
I think that's lesser of the rule. I think that's, yeah, I think that's less than what happens often. Like let me give you an example, kind of jumble up of a client case that I'll jumble up. So it's not factual, but, let's see how I can do that. So a client basically knows that they're extremely, extremely, extremely stressed out with, you know, school.
Yep.
And they know that they hate the school that they chose. And so they go on vacation from school and their pain goes away. And then they come back and they focus on the chair they're sitting in and the pain comes back. And they focus on the reason the pain came back was because the chair they're sitting in, not because they're back at the school they hate.
Yep.
So I think sometimes it's right under the tip of our nose. Maybe not the memories that you're talking about, like these subconscious deep memories from the past. But oftentimes the current day stress factors are right under our nose, but we're just fighting them. So we do know, you know.
Yep.
But as far as like past memories and past traumas and past – I think often we do know those too. I mean, we know what's happened in our lives. We may just be denying them. We may just be avoiding looking at them.
Right.
And we may not know exactly the one thing that's causing the pain. But that's not necessarily, I think, important to pinpoint.
I agree. And that's like a big it seems like time after time over the last 7 or 8 months as I've interviewed different practitioners or coaches or therapists or whatever, that kind of the big thing to hammer home, Dr. Mike Murray, I think, said it the best on this show where he was talking about, you know, this thought of all this stuff being totally under the surface and we're not going to be able to access it. He said, that seems like a really disempowering notion to share with somebody.
Yeah.
That's their life already feels like it's an out of control truck. And you're now telling them
right.
You're never going to know what it is. And you don't really have any control over the fact that it's there or not. He's like, you know, throw up your hands. Like, what do I even do now?
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a sweeping generalization. And right. Again, I think most of us know what happened in our lives.
Yep. Yep.
You know? And so we just work with, you know, we work with what's still currently distressing. And that's maybe where the EMDR can come in or the journaling or whatever, you know, style the therapist uses.
Dr. Huggins, we are way over an hour. And
but
that's your timer went off. And actually my alert went off because I've got to wrap here too. But I, you know, are there any closing thoughts? Where can people find you? You know, they may listen to this and say, gosh, there's so much that she said that really resonates. And I'm just curious. So just talk about how people can reach you, find you, that kind of stuff.
So my website is painpsychologistla.com. So it's all one word, painpsychologistla.com. So they can find me on there. My phone number's on there. My email's on there. So that would be the best place.
Awesome. Talk about who you can work with versus who you can't work with so people know.
Yeah. So I work with most all pain syndromes. So back, neck, you know, migraines, fibromyalgia, CRPS, plantar fasciitis, you know, the whole smorgasbord. But I don't work with cancer pain.
Okay.
I don't work with multiple sclerosis pain, and or cerebral palsy pain. So I work with just, you know, TMS pain.
Okay.
And I always make sure that that's been validated by, you know, an MD. And if there's any doubt, then I certainly try to send them over to a TMS MD or have them get, you know, the stamp of approval. If I can't always, but if I can. And yeah, so that would be the main thing, because I'd say, you know, the majority of chronic pain, in my opinion, is going to be TMS, not all, but the majority. And if I have any doubt, I always make sure that I get medical backup to make sure.
Dr. Huggins, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.